served in your witness.
Yeah. You would have already seen there's a few errors for which I apologise, but my 2-day hearing last week before Jesus Smith turned into a 4-week, so I got jammed up with it, and I had to stop correcting late last night and get organised, so I'm sorry about that. So do you want me to...
Yes, I think Visa can take us through it, because I've read them quickly.
Paragraph 1 refers to the further submission for Joan Williams and myself, which opposed all parts of the submission 715 by the Jardine Group. And I made 4 key points there which you may have looked at, and I think they are all relevant reasons for declining the submission. I've referred back to my statement of evidence given as part of the hearing what should be topic 09, that was a mistake. And I've just identified the relevant paragraphs without taking you back to them, because at that stage, when I prepared that evidence, I wasn't aware that, not coming down here and doing hearings all the time, I wasn't aware that the Jardine matter was going to be moved over into the matter. So I did address that, and I identified the paragraph numbers in there. And I've also particularly referred to Appendix E, which is a copy of the decision of the Council on Variation 16. And I believe the history of how the zone was created in the first place, and in particular how the landowners on each side made submissions and secured some additions to the original proposal, is a very relevant consideration here. So a focus of these submissions is going to relate to the presence on the Jardine property of a farm airstrip. And I think it is important to understand, you may or may not, you were going to take a site visit at the last
yes.
And you will have seen maybe the airstrip that's there.
And you've seen the planes landing and taking off on it,
yep.
Yes.
Yep.
I do note later in your submissions you say that they come from the south and then turn onto the strip. All of them seem to come directly from the west.
Yes, well,
straight over Jack's Hill.
There is first of all a difference between what happens at different times of the year. I think depending on the wind and weather conditions, and also on how much the golf course is in use, makes a difference as to how much of the flight path, particularly coming in, they will use a lot of the golf course, as it were, to land. I also would say that when we had the direct referral hearing, they made some point of saying that was their normal path, and Clive Geddes was a party, and obviously I was involved, and we parted company about that because it's not what we'd observed. But nonetheless, the decision of the court, and I think you've had it given to you twice now,
yes.
And I've referred you to a lot of paragraphs in there, and the court records that. So certainly they're able to come in from the south. I think there was always a reticence from the Jardines, who were occupying the big homestead in Homestead Bay, about that, because they ended up going
over
to the house.
Yes.
And of course it's an issue now for this new concept of theirs, which has not been referred to in their evidence. I was counsel during that hearing, as you will have seen from the decision, representing the Jack's Point residents through the Owners Association and also collectively the Jack's Point commercial interests. And I've given you two of my attachments are statements of evidence given on behalf of Jack's Point by Dr. Trevathan, who was a noise expert, and if you read the Environment Court evidence, you'll see that evidence was preferred on important differences, in particular the question of frequency and averaging. And Mr. Fulton, the air safety expert, and the reason I've given you his evidence is twofold. One is to draw to your attention that there are completely unaddressed air safety issues about ending up with a farm airstrip and a commercial skydive operation sandwiched between, within a few hundred yards either side of an operation like that. And it's my submission that it's simply not possible to address the question of whether it's appropriate to put that residential development in there within 200 metres to the south without considering air safety issues. And what I read into the Jardine presentation so far is they've completely ignored the implications of leaving a skydive operation on a farm airstrip in the middle of residential in their proposal. So that was the first reason, to alert you to the fact that when we had the hearing, and it was talking about increases, but nonetheless dealing with air safety issues. And secondly, because Mr. Fogden's evidence deals with a particular engine characteristics of this of the planes they're using in relation to noise mitigation. I must say I was disappointed to read Stephen Child's evidence, where basically he just repeated what he'd said to the Environment Court. He hasn't been out there and had a look at the operation again, and I don't think his evidence is complete, and I'll obviously get to that later. I note that the Council's planning witness, Ms. Jones, has suggested that submitters should bring forward evidence on aircraft noise to address the panel. That wasn't entirely clear, but I got the impression she was referring to the JPROA or people like me, and I think that that's not right. Despite the evidence of Mr. Childs, no evidence, and that evidence was obviously in first, no evidence has been provided by Jardine on aircraft noise issues in your recent minute is not a surprise to me. Given that the proposition is that the farm airstrip remains operational, including for the existing skydive operation, but is brought inside the Jack's Point zone boundary, the failure of Jardine to present expert evidence from acoustic and aircraft safety expert witnesses is a notable shortcoming. In my submission, it is the submitter, Jardine, as proponent of the change in the zone provisions in relation to the airstrip. And that's my first reference there, that it's important to understand that by definition, in the new plan, that's called an informal airport. That carries the evidential burden of placing sufficient evidence before, I should have said, sorry, the court. That should have been the panel. The reason is I was thinking about the Environment Court decisions, which are really, I mean, they're well known to you about evidential burden. Yes. To establish that a change in the zone provisions as notified is appropriate, not submitted such as myself. In addition, I made submissions to the panel in respect of the same topic on the 17th of February, and I would like to rely on, without repeating paragraphs, and I identified those there, the latter paragraphs referencing my and Mr. Tim Williams' revision on behalf of the Jack's Point Residents Group, as distinguished from the Owners Association, that, as you know, we maintain does not represent us as residents. And I had presented in, as part of that submission, a revision of the Jack's Point zone provisions. So that's, if you like, a revision from our own perspective. Having considered, as far as I've been able, in the time available, the multiple revisions of the zone presented by the Jardine Planner Nick Geddes, and I mean, I find that really difficult. And even now, there's another one, and you're dealing with it all the time, and again, I saw a minute. So I was battling to actually follow what Nick keeps changing. But my position is that all the revisions that he proposes should be disallowed, and that follows from my view that the request under 715 should be disallowed. I'll refer to some of the more important provisions that I oppose without detracting from my opposition to all of them. So I also mentioned there, and I don't know whether this has come up yet for you, again, when it's a function of me being here very occasionally, but Plan Change 44 is finally wrapped itself up. Have you been provided with a consent order yet?
No. Well, in reality, it doesn't affect us.
Well, no, it doesn't, except that as it's panned out, it is something you should see. I've made a footnote there. I hadn't been involved in the submissions of Plan Change 44. Mr. Schrantz was brave enough to, not that I'm not brave if I want to be, but there are these covenant issues. But when I saw that Plan Change 44 was going to be provided with evidence exchange and a hearing before these hearings, I lodged a 274 notice, which Judge Jackson dealt with, asking that the procedural issue be dealt with, and I had states to do that. And I suggested that that should not be heard before these review hearings, because otherwise you're going to debate the whole thing all over again.
Mm.
And there was a memorandum suggesting there was some merit in that, and all the other parties gave way. And the result was nothing went ahead. And then the parties interested in the appeals went ahead with trying to resolve things by appeal.
Mm.
And ultimately, everything's been left in Plan Change 44 as it was in the operative plan, apart from some necessary alterations that were suited and I was happy with. So I've signed off, and everyone else has signed off, a consent memorandum. And I'm expecting that logically the council will let you know what the outcome of that was. I just thought I should mention that.
The only problem with that, in a procedural sense, if it raises issues to how we should deal with matters raised in Stream 9, we're going to have to reopen that hearing and rehear the people on that. So
yes,
I'd rather not get into that.
That's fine. I mean,
it's
really
unnecessary.
I just thought that I was likely to be the first person involved in Plan Change 44 to turn up.
I'd be quite happy to hear about it after May of the
okay.
year when the council's made these decisions.
Pretend I didn't say that then. So I support and rely on the evidence of Jo Day. Now she told me in an email this morning she put that evidence under her married name.
Yeah,
so it'll be under Jo Taverna.
Yes.
And Tim Williams, who I think's already put his evidence in as well.
Yes, and
apart from Clive Geddes, who had an obvious difficulty relating to this hearing. We have combined to present evidence, I guess, of people with some expertise in different areas on these issues. In this instance, I also rely on the evidence that has been provided by the Residents Association. As stated in my previous evidence and submissions, my starting point is that there must be good reason to depart from the operative plan provisions for the Jack's Point zone established through the Variation 16 process, like the Millbrook Special Zone, which I've footnoted, I've never looked at the Waterfall Park one. The Jack's Point Special Zone was developed as a standalone, master planned residential and visitor resort community within a rural environment and landscape exhibiting special qualities. Both zones are intended to contribute to visitor employment and economic development, hence the reference to them being resort zones. In relation to the proposed addition of new provisions, and namely residential development of the Hanley Downs landholding to the north of the existing Jack's Point residential community, our submission urged the establishment of a separate Hanley Downs zone, as originally proposed by Plan Change 44. My submissions and evidence, though, also recognise that by the time the matter came before the panel, resource consents had been issued to enable development to proceed, and the evidence was that the District Council had agreed to extend council services reticulation to the property. In my submission, these are crucial differences between that area to the north and the proposed expansion to the south of Jack's Point of what has been referred to by the Jardine Group as Homestead Bay, but in reality it is not. And I think that's quite an important point. It is quite wrong to label what they propose to do Homestead Bay. It is not Homestead Bay, it's actually the farm. In fact, the area where the significant residential development is proposed through the Jardine submission is part of the Remarkable Station Farm, and what is proposed through submission 715, apart from some relatively minor suggested changes to development opportunities, is quite distinct and different from the discrete development, the word and shouldn't be there, enabled at Homestead Bay by the operative plan provisions. The Hanley Downs residential development is inside the UGB, whether or not the existing Jack's Point residential and commercial areas are included. And while I oppose the inclusion of the Jack's Point zone within the urban growth boundary, I do acknowledge that with services reticulation now being a given through to the consented Hanley Downs residential development, the land west of State Highway 6 and north of that location through the Kawarau River is going to be a significant new area of residential development. I mean, I think Marion Reid said that in the evidence during Topic 9, and I'm sorry to see it happen. I understand that once you reticulate out to the south to Handley Downs through that land, then the rest of it is going to be targeted and it's within the urban growth boundary. So, now I thought that was a major shortcoming in McGeddy's work on why there needed to be additional development on the Remarkable Station, and he argued the need for capacity. And as far as I could read in the time available, his evidence, he never acknowledged the capacity that's now effectively been created from Handley Downs down, which I think negates his argument on the need to expand into Remarkable Station to provide further capacity. He simply left out that large area of land that would be available. By contrast, the area of residential expansion proposed through the Jardine submission is outside the proposed UGB, and the extension of the urban boundary requested by evidence and legal submissions for Jardine ought to be rejected, not the least because it is contrary to objectives and policies in the proposed plan. As I said in my previous submission, the request is opportunistic and, if accepted, would enable urban sprawl. Now, I've got a little bit more time now, so there's a few things I'd like...
Too much more.
Yeah, well...
I've heard you several times, I understand.
Yeah, just a little bit more. I should have mentioned my wife Eleanor's here because she's a co-owner as well,
yes.
and I wrongly left her on the list of submitters, but I didn't put her mention those here.
We have met in the past.
Yes. So... I noticed that Nick tried to make out that sprawl meant sprawl that was visible. And I just wanted to say, I think that's an untenable argument. If we think about the concepts of sporadic or sprawling subdivision and development, it actually has nothing to do with whether you can see it. It is very much tied to this concept of integrated and planned expansion, and therefore is not determined by whether or not you can see something, which, of course, is the whole problem with what they propose. You know, if you put it there and you can't see it, it's still providing development, but it's nonetheless broad. In my submission, there are several objectives and policies which the proposed expansion of residential development on the Remarkable Station farm cannot meet or comply with. There are other relevant provisions I wish to refer to in relation to informal airports and the noise controls. And so I mentioned that it's unlikely I'd have time, and you may not have looked at it yet, but what I did yesterday when I was found through this is I used the highlighting on the computer and highlighted the provisions I wish to draw to your attention. Now, if we look at the strategic chapter, and these chapters are refreshingly simple. It's fun, quite pleased, actually.
But we don't have...
Up there, they're part of my attachments.
Your attachments.
And so they're in my attachments, and I've highlighted them because I thought, well, I'm never going to get time, Mr. Chairman, to refer to them. But on this question of expansion of urban development, I've highlighted development occurring in a logical manner, compact, well-designed and integrated, protecting the rural landscape from sporadic and sprawling development. Well, I mean, I just think that this proposal is contrary to that starting point, and it goes on to deal with connectivity and integration, sustainable provision of infrastructure and facilitation of efficient transport networks, and avoiding development outside the UGB. Well, you could deal with that by expanding the UGB, but I think there's a very good reason not to. So I didn't have, I must say, a great deal of trouble looking in these objectives in Chapter 3 and Chapter 4 and finding provisions that this proposal is contrary to. So maybe I'll just leave it at that, because I do think I need to make sure I spend enough time on the airport issue.
Yes.
Variation 16, so I've gone through there, and what I've done there is first of all acknowledge that, of course, the district plan review is the appropriate and expected opportunity for a review, and an outcome for a review will be change provisions. And that will enable use and development of natural and physical resources and have regard to the need to provide for future needs. But I think, and this is my submission, that doesn't mean that a great deal of care shouldn't be taken when reviewing the district's special zones. Because leaving aside Waterfall Park, that I don't know about, those zones are special because they're master planned and they have an integrity of their own. And I say that the required Section 32 analysis should include consideration of the risk of acting or not acting if there is uncertain knowledge and or insufficient knowledge. Now, this is a question of whether it's appropriate to leave the zone as it is or expand it. And I put a footnote in here because where is the Section 32 analysis by the Jardine witnesses? Because I had trouble finding it. I'm sorry to ask a question, because I haven't had the time, but I couldn't find one.
No, you've seen what we've seen.
Yes.
Mr. Geddes didn't attempt it in a small way in an appendix, I think, but not in the way I would have done a Section 32,
Well, 32 yes, I was a bit reticent. Yesterday evening preparing this because I thought, well, I don't want to come along and assert that he didn't do it, and I haven't had a chance to read the documents, but I couldn't see one. And I mean, that's a starting point. If you don't do the analysis, on what basis can you then say that the changes should be approved? So I'm sure that at least two of you, and no disrespect to Commissioner Mountford, but James London, if you look in that original report, that little, well not little, but that village development by the lakeside was designed by James Lundy, and I've been involved with him before, and he is a very experienced and skilled urban designer, particularly in relation to small villages and urban and rural type development of that nature. And I don't think it's possible now to probably locate his evidence. But I think the starting point is that Jardine and his fellow submitter at that time put forward a specific proposal carefully designed to fit into Homestead Bay and link deliberately to the Jack's Point development, and that was accepted. And I think that's the starting point. And there's a very succinct description, and I've given you the page references of the elements of the proposed village development. And I'm alarmed at the, I've got to say, casual approach, not only by the submitter, but I have to say by the council assessment, in terms of moving away so easily from that carefully designed proposal that was to be integrated and be a proper part of the Jack's Point Master Plan. On page 22, the report refers to ensuring desired outcomes are realised through adopting another method, namely the stakeholder's deed. I remind you that I produced for you, or no, someone else had produced a copy of the stakeholder's deed. But I think this is a very important document, and I feel it should still be in the new plan provisions as another method. I'm not aware, but then there's a lot of New Zealand and what's happened in district planning that I don't know. I'm not aware of something quite like the stakeholder's deeds that have been used in the past by the district council. They amount to a contract between the parties concerned that enabled the Jack's Point zone to move forward the way it did. And as with the proponents of changes enabling development of hand-me-downs, which is a principal reason why I object to it staying in the Jack's Point zone, Jardine now proposes extensive development that would change completely the master planned Homestead Bay Village and add some 500 residential units on the farm property. And what that means is that the property owners to the north and south of the Jack's Point development are now acting in breach of that stakeholder's deed, which is a contract entered into with the other landowners and the council. So next, the decision report deals with a submission by Jardine and Bock to extend the zone boundary to include Homestead Bay. And I ask that you please read this section through because it contains a careful examination of development potential in this location, including reference to the extensive landscape visibility and absorption capacity analysis work that was available through the Coburn Area Resource Study. Like Joe, I was amazed that Mr. Espy completed his landscape assessment, so-called, without a single reference, because I read his evidence again carefully, to the Coburn Area Resource Study. In summary, I refer in particular to the identified positive outcomes of the master planned Homestead Bay Village was included, the detailed assessment of landscape effects, consideration of infrastructure needs, and that if development was contained at Homestead Bay, the district plan objectives and policies would be achieved with other areas retained as open space suitable for recreation and other outdoor pursuits. The section concluded by referring to the outcomes advocated by the submitter being ensured by the landowners agreeing to develop in accordance with the development controls for the zone and the design guidelines for Homestead Bay. That obligation to be achieved by the use of covenants on land titles and entrenched in the stakeholder's deed and the JPC provisions. Now, as I said, I acknowledge people can come along to a review some years later and ask for change. But I believe that change has to be considered in the context of what was put in place, the commitments made, and the nature of those, instead of just completely ignoring them as if they have no relevance anymore. Under section 16.4, references made to submissions regarding public access to Lake Wakatipu, open space and recreation facilities. And it was Jardine himself who requested an amendment to the zone provisions by adding reference to Homestead Bay, providing particular opportunities for public access to and enjoyment of the lake. And as with other residents who have purchased land at Jack's Point, the information we were provided indicated that in the future that development would be proceeding in accordance with the zone provisions, and the trails and the access opportunities would be extended out to that facility and enable access to Lake Tipu. And Tim Williams has addressed the shortcoming in the proposal that Jardine has now put up in terms of public access with cycleway and walkway trails. In relation to roading infrastructure, the decision records that the proposed addition of Homestead Bay included a proposal to realign and form an existing paper road, which was an extension of Walkshed Road, that formation having now been extended during the development of Jack's Point to the boundary of the Jardine property, and since very recently extended in there as a result of the Jardines selling some of their land and gifting some to the University, Otago University. This road was developed to a standard as to design and construction in keeping with the other private roads within the Jack's Point development, and to accommodate only the expected traffic flows from Homestead Bay Village. Now, you've been into the Jack's Point development now, and the way in which those roads develop, the way that they're done as private roads, enables a form of development that's particularly appropriate in a setting. I mean, introducing wider roads and things like curving and channeling means that you end up completely at odds with the whole way in which the development has proceeded, leaving aside any other considerations of the effect of those on the private roadway, which is met, the cost of maintenance and upkeep is met by the residents who live there. It was not developed and is not suitable for the additional development now proposed. The suggestion that it could be upgraded to accommodate additional traffic if the village development is approved through variation 16 is abandoned and the other proposed development now presented proceeds is not acceptable to me as a resident of Jack's Point, and nor, I believe, would it be to many other residents. Apart from unresolved issues of funding, upgrades and future maintenance, if the proposed development on the Jardine property proceeds, but none of the new residents on the Jardine land are members of the JPROA. See, we've ended up with the same thing. Both of these people who joined in the previous arrangements are now saying, well, they have nothing to do with the infrastructure arrangements and the joining in as residents of the owners association. So the master plan of Jack's Point included the design and layout of those private roads. I refer to section 10.6.7 and 6.10.10 of the decision on the variation, which records that the Jardine and box submissions resulted in the amended zone purpose wording in the operative plan and the provisions for new activity areas within Homestead Bay. So they promoted all of that. The same submitters sought and the council adopted into the proposed plan provisions limitations on residential units and zone standards, including planting requirements and coverage controls, and I note the proposal by Jardine and Bock that site coverage be restricted to 2.5%. And again, I don't think it's good enough that people who actually promoted those provisions, important provisions, controlling development on their property, come along now and there's not a mention of why circumstances enable them to walk away from those commitments. Finally, I refer, this is quite interesting, to section 2.6.2.16 that addressed the economic viability of the land resource, the subject of the variation, and includes reference to reports on economic viability, including one prepared in respect of the remarkable station property. So Mr. Moore addressed the economic viability of the station as an ongoing farming entity, having regard to the reduced land area resulting from the requested addition of the Homestead Bay area as a master plan village. The report of the decision report concludes that the proposed zone, including the requested addition of the village, would not compromise the remarkable station as a viable rural land appropriate for farming activities. I accept that circumstances, including viability farming operations, can change, but note that the panel has nothing other than bald statements that the land is subject to expansion, this proposal is no longer viable for farming, or just that the owner's changed his mind. So turning now to this proposal, first of all, I made the point I accept that it's not necessary to do a full design or come to a plan review with resource consents for infrastructure facilities. In my submission, though, it is fensible to suggest, as the Jardine evidence does, that you could rely on the prospect of council reticulation within the life of this plan. I think that's just plain fanciful. It is also clear that for whatever reason, Jardine does not propose to rely on any aspect of the existing Jacks Point infrastructure, even though the stakeholders' deed provisions and the way in which the water supply infrastructure in particular has been developed was intended to accommodate both Homestead Bay and the Henley Downs residential areas. In my submission, at least in respect of water supply, there is an issue with the evidence presented, which relates to the suggestion that the required reservoir could be located on Jack's Hill. Now, that evidence is only from the infrastructure engineer suggesting that somewhere up there you could put one. Nothing from Mr. Espy about it. Given the landscape values and visual significance of that feature, and if you've got to get a reservoir on high ground, I submit a proper landscape analysis of a potential site or sites was essential to support the zone extension proposal. Transportation. First, in my submission, it is now recognised, indeed I just spent a week in the Environment Court about this, that provision for infrastructure, for transportation in an integrated way required attention to not just roading for vehicles, but also cycling and walking. The Jardine evidence does not address this appropriately. In my submission, the weight which you might otherwise give to the evidence of Mr. Bartlett is affected by his quite proper disclosure that he is a landowner of Jack's Point and presently a committee member of the Owners Association. His evidence includes reference to the acceptability of increased vehicle usage of Murray Jack Road, which he acknowledges is a private road owned and maintained by the association. In paragraph 19 of that primary evidence, he suggests that what he describes as development at Homestead Bay, but in fact is on the remarkable station property, could use the access through Murray Jack Road to State Highway 6, and therefore through the existing Jacks Point residential agreement, developed with the prior agreement of JPROA. As a committee member of the association, he must be well aware that at present the affairs of the association are under the control of the Jacks Point commercial interests, that the chairman of the association is a director of these companies who will and have in relation to a range of contentious changes to development and use of commercial or even association land exercised their preemptive voting rights. They've done that again in the last month and a half, with or without the approval or even input of the committee. While Mr. Bartlett may have modified his position, so I have no confidence at all in it being left in the hands of JPROA. While Mr. Bartlett may have modified his position in subsequent evidence, the provision of access directly from State Highway 6 into the proposed new residential development is not proposed on the basis that access from the property onto Murray Jack Road would be discontinued, and that's where I have a continuing problem. As the bulk of residential and commercial traffic, including construction traffic, which all of us residents know is very significant during the development phases, will be travelling on departure to the north and on arrival will come to the north. So the existing access into Jacks Point to and from State Highway 6 will remain an attractive option by contrast to an access off State Highway 6 further south. In my submission, the transport infrastructure proposals are inadequately developed to provide confidence they are viable and suitable and failed to provide for appropriate integrated transport options, sorry the words in there twice, they assumed the continued right of access onto the private roadway of Marrickap Road when that connection was agreed, then built by others on the basis of the current land provisions for Homestead Bay. The contrast is hand-me-downs. Now, because it's been possible to force them to build and their own separate access, which was another outcome of my filing 274 notice on Plan Change 44. What happens there is that when that access is in, of course, all of the bulk of the traffic will simply take the first access, so it won't be a problem for us. But the problem with the development to the south is that the opposite situation applies. Landscape character and visual effects. In relation to the requested expansion of urban development and changes, the Jardine submission is supported by evidence of Mr. Espy dated 9 June 2017. While the evidence does make reference to the operative Homestead Bay structure plan, there is no recognition of the proposal as presented by Mr. Lundy and described in the decision report on variation 16, in particular as to its acceptability in respect of landscape character, landscape visibility and absorption capability as discussed in that report. Notable is the omission from this evidence of any reference to the Coneburn study. This is surprising and I submit must surely reflect in the lesser weight being given to the assessment done by Mr. Espy, given the study is the only comprehensive landscape study of the area. In relation to what Mr. Espy describes as land use development patterns that will appear on the ground and the effect on existing landscape character, he acknowledges that the proposed suburban development would total approximately 50 hectares, or approximately half the size of the already built residential development within Jack's Point. Gives you a good visual picture. What he calls the suburban area, requested through submission 715, he describes as totaling 14.4 hectares in area, with considerable earthworks proposed to hide the development from State Highway 6. His large sweeping hummock of high topography that accommodates stands of native vegetation, needs to be understood as an artificially created landform, utilising large volumes of material excavated to form depressions or bowls within which the new housing would be established. I was invited by Nick Geddes to a meeting with him and the surveyor before the hearings, where they first told me about what was proposed. In my submission, his suggestion the treatment will echo that of the Jack's Point Highway frontage further north is to minimise the adverse effects on landscape character that would arise, not only because the mounding created to achieve the mitigation along State Highway 6 that the operative plan zone provisions require extends only along a portion of the highway frontage north of the Jack's Point State Highway 6 intersection, but that mounding is more modest and discreet than what would be essential here. As referred to in the evidence of Mrs. Taverner, the proposed earthworks would be significant and completely alter the existing landform and therefore landscape character of the open rural farmland in this location. The last two sentences of this paragraph 5.14 as to adverse effects on landscape character and the ability of this area to absorb additional suburban development without degrading landscape character are, I submit, not only unconvincing but contrary to the Coneburn study assessment of landscape character and absorption capacity and failed to provide the panel with an adequate assessment on the usual scale of adverse effects that you would expect. So are the adverse effects minor, more than minor, significant, major? I mean, I couldn't find a proper assessment. The assessment as to adverse visual effects is also deficient. Because of the proposed major earthwork changes to the existing landform the Jardine submission proposes, the result is extensive high mounding for the express purpose of hiding the substantial residential development from views from State Highway 6 and to a lesser extent from adjoining residential development in Jack's Point. The adverse visual effects viewing the resulting residential development from the lake cannot be avoided, and I submit would be significant. However, in the process of developing and then assessing this crude method of hiding a large housing development, the result creates its own adverse visual effects. It prevents views across the land towards the lake, which are currently extensive, and the artificially created hummocks, as Mr. Espy describes them, will be detrimental as they will be a discordant element in the landform and therefore the present appearance as described in the Coneberg study. By contrast, as you've seen at Jack's point, the natural topography, although it's had some alteration, is quite different through the existing Jack's Point development. It's much more broken up and hummocky as a natural landform. In my submission, Mr. Espy's proposition that the adverse visual effects of this artificially created hummocked feature used to screen hundreds of residential houses and their associated infrastructure and development should be viewed in the context of what can be presently seen by users of State Highway 6 as they drive south past Jack's Point, and so avoids the issue which is the requirement to assess the degree of adverse effect. There is no assessment of the visual outcomes for those who would be placed into these depressions or bowls created by extensive earthworks, even though the screening effect works both ways. So what would it be like for the development inside these areas? In my submission, the methodology ought to be rejected, including because of significant adverse effects on landscape character and visual amenity. The proposal conflicts with assessments in the study. The assessment of the proposed man-made changes through extensive earthworking is inadequate, and the information provided is insufficient to accurately assess outcomes. As I read the changes to the plan provisions proposed in Mr. Geddes' latest iteration, these major earthworks would be provided for within the zone provisions in a way that exempted them from the type of examination that earthworks of this nature would normally require, including opportunity for public input. As I understand the various amendments proposed by Mr. Geddes, the land area where the farm airstrip is located...
Just before you start with this section, I wonder if you could summarise it for us.
Okay.
Mainly because we're locked by the clock.
We're what?
We're at 5 o'clock.
Okay.
So if you could, if that's the rest of your submission to relate to the airstrip.
Yes,
yes.
It is. Okay.
So if you take us to the high points and we'll certainly read them.
Sure. My first issue relates to including the airstrip within the Jack's Point site. And then labelling it open space golf. Which I think is not the only, but certainly one of the worst manipulations of the Jack's Point zone provisions. I mean, this is indicative of what's being done here. You take a zone that's carefully crafted, and all of these different areas have been notated, and they work, and they fit around the development, and they have good reason. And then you adopt them, and you butcher them up sometimes, but you misuse them for other purposes. So open space golf is one of the important things that I was surprised to see that Ms. Jones suggested that would be okay, admittedly on a fallback. The wording reads, open space golf, the use of this area is restricted to indigenous revegetation and outdoor recreation activities. And okay, it says included, but obviously the focus is on golf. It does refer to mining of rock, aggregate and gravel within the golf course. And then you need to look at the structure plan. Where is this notation placed? On the golf course. And another area, which has always been identified as the future nine-hole golf course and nowhere else. And it's absolutely inappropriate and wrong to then place that notation on what's a farm airstrip with a commercial recreation activity operating on it. It makes a nonsense of the provision. So that's my first point. The next thing that really alarmed me, paragraph 32, he purports to shift the rule provisions prescribing activity status to table 41.5, which is a table setting out standards applicable to various activities. So in the first place, the shift is unlawful. Now, have you noticed that?
I think that's one of the things in my minute notice. There was some revision of the rules. Even Mr. Page noticed that.
Well, I've left this submission aside because I'm not going to answer directly. It's just loosely mentioned in a footnote on the side. You can't shift the activity provisions into standards tables, but the cunning plan behind that was to move those activities out and then rely on the permitted activity provision at the beginning of the table. Now, I think that's not only disingenuous, but it's potentially misleading. And these people actually pick up what's going on. But that was an attempt to subvert the arrangements about aircraft activities in the Jack's Point zone. And that's
we did pick it up at the hearing.
Hmm?
We did pick that up.
So The definition section in the new plan includes one of informal airport. In fact, a lot of things that were floating during the Environment Court hearing have been resolved. The definition makes it plain that designated aerodromes are excluded, so they're not included in an informal airport. To my knowledge, the existing Jacks Point development makes provision for a number of helicopter landing sites in specific and identified locations. There is no provision for fixed-wing aircraft. So that's another reason to stop this nonsense happening of moving the farm airstrip and the skydive operation into the zone. Table 1, activities located within the JPZ, provides at 41.212 for informal airports. They're limited to helicopter use as a discretionary activity, the establishment or operation of all other airport activity or an aerodrome, including informal airports used by fixed-wing aircraft, is non-compliant. So if that's the zone structure, this facility does not fit within the Jacks Point zone. In the rural zone, Rule 21.425 provides that informal airports that comply with Table 6 are permitted. So that's the zone that should fit in. Table 6, and I've given you the rule, restricts use to a frequency of 3 per week, allows for emergency landings and the like, and imposes a locational restriction of no less than 500 metres from any formed legal road or notional boundary of any residential unit or, it should read, building platform. Now, this is quite important because that has been completely disregarded by the Jardine presentation. The continuation of a rural zoning on a remarkable station farm property would enable continued lawful use without resource consent of the existing farm estuary. The locational restriction would prevent the proposed residential development sought through the Jardine submission, which is inappropriate anyway if Skydive continues to operate there. The use of this farm airstrip is under a 1997 consent. And I think IWAS was very important, and I've given you a copy of the decision and the application that was made by Jane McDonald in 1996 for this. And I remember we produced this to the Environment Court because it gives you an idea of what the existing environment was when that skydive operation was consented. So, by reference to page 6 of the application, there were no residences or residents within 2 kilometres of takeoff and landing when that strip went in. And so I refer to the refusal of the application that sought to increase the number of flights and also to try and set special noise standards that would apply to the activity, and that was turned down. So the activity now must comply with the operative plan noise controls, and it will have to comply with the proposed district plan noise controls, and that's important, Mr. Chairman. And I refer to Mr. Child's evidence to the new proposed residential development coming to within 200 metres of the flight path. And what that means is it won't comply with the locational control in the rural zone, and nor will it comply with the noise controls. So the legal submissions make a number of unsupported assertions about the operation, and I've given you the decision or refer to it so you can understand why the proposition of developing substantial residential buildings and activities just to the south is completely inappropriate. So the only way this could happen in the future, surely, is that the airstrip needs to be discontinued as a farm airstrip. You don't have farm aerial top dressing flying out from an open space area between residential development. And it does get used for that. And nor, of course, should there be a commercial skydive operation in that location. And in my view, the Jardines had an opportunity to make sure that this airstrip was moved into a more sensible location. They own a large farm property and that needed to be attended to. So I talked there about the skydiving, the number of people that go up in the aircraft, the operation starting as early as 8 in the morning and continuing to 8:30 during the best weather and longest flying hours, and that coincides with outdoor residential amenity, which is another issue which Mr. Charles never addressed in the, Dr. Charles never addressed in the Environment Court, and he hasn't addressed again. All he talks about is a 55 metre noise contour, which is an inappropriate provision to apply to this airport because it only applies using the standard to airports that are not informal airports. There is no provision in this plan to apply that contour approach under the NZS standard And the only reason it got addressed through the Environment Court decision is because there was a hole in the old plan as to how you went about doing things. So I went on to say, it's not just a matter of the noise created by the activity, it is also a question of safe aircraft operations and safe landings by the skydivers. There is a designated landing zone, but wind conditions or problems in achieving a landing on the designated area right by the operations building could mean resort to what is presently open farmland. This is a farm airstrip that's been used with no control of the airspace, only the pilots between themselves, and they are crossing over, coming in and out, flying in and out two aircraft in the summer at the maximum frequency rotation that they can achieve, and they have got parachutists coming down towards the ground with aircraft landing and taking off. You haven't seen that, but I and plenty of other residents have, and that's the environment that we're talking about. And to add more residential on the other side of it to the south, I think requires addressing aircraft safety. So I've said something about that. I talked about Mr. Trevathan carrying out noise readings, and the problem is that his readings, which Mr. Charles didn't do, he did other readings of other aircraft that we used previously, showed that there was a real problem with aircraft idling on the ground. And in fact, that is the biggest problem, and the reason that I've explained there is because they use a turboprop engine in the latest aircraft. Because of the type of engine, they don't shut it off during the day, so when it's on the ground waiting and to be loaded up or for the next people to arrive, they keep it running. There's a particular noise problem that creates a cone, and what they said they will do during the Environment Court hearing is rotate the aircraft, so instead of facing down the runway, that's to the west, they would turn it to the south. And that way they could meet the 55 dBA noise control, which Dr. Trevathan would prove they couldn't meet even up at Hackett Drive. And that's 600 metres away. If they did noise mitigate, which they've stopped doing, even though they said they would do it, if they noise mitigated like that, they'd point the aircraft straight at the new residential area of the Jardine property. So the trouble is Dr. Charles thinks that noise mitigation has been applied because he doesn't know. And secondly, he hasn't given thought to what the evidence was about how you noise mitigate. You can't noise mitigate now, because you can't point it towards Jack, the aircraft towards Jack's point, you can't point it the other way. And pointing down like it does at the moment, straight down the runway, exceeds the noise levels, even at 55. So that's a continuing problem that hasn't been addressed. So I've referred there to the experts in this case agreeing that 55 dBLDM was appropriate. The court expressed misgivings about the use of that, and one of the reasons was because of averaging and the frequency and type of aircraft activities, and I won't go into that now, we'll run out of time. But I do make the point, and Dr. Charles should have made this plain, that 55, as the court pointed out, Judge Jackson did, is a maximum. It's a not to be exceeded number. And it's very easy to refer to it and say, oh well, 50, you know, it can meet 55, but that's to be regarded as a maximum. The court also quite properly referred to Section 16 of the Act and the obligation under that. So let's now look at the new provisions about noise in Chapter 36. So 36.326 states that notwithstanding compliance with 36.514, fixed-wing aircraft, which is the noise control in Table 3, informal airports shall be subject to the rules in the applicable zones. 36.51 specifies at any point within the notional boundary of a residential unit in a rural zone, a 50 dB LAQ 15 minute applies. And Rule 36.53 specifies the same maximum noise level at any point within the residential activity areas in the Jack's Point resort zone. So, Mr. Chairman, as I read the new noise controls, they've remedied the problem we had in Jack's Point, which was that there were no noise controls because there were no aircraft intended apart from some specific helicopter operations. Control that Dr. Charles refers to in my submission is wrong. He should never have used 55, because the control now is a 50 LAEQ 15 minute. And on the basis of the information available from Dr. Trevathan's measurements at Hackett Drive, this can't meet that by a substantial margin. And if the other residential is within 200 metres, well, then it's obvious. So rule 36.514, fixed wing aircraft specifies 55 dBLN at all times at any point within the notional boundary. From airport landing strips being measured and assessed in accordance with NCS 6805 1992. And that appears to be the approach adopted by Dr. Childs, contrary to rule 36.326, which imposes a different noise regime on informal airports. And of course the reason is because they're only expected to operate, you know, the frequency I mentioned. There's also a locational dimension that I mentioned just a while ago. So, of course, they're not to be treated like an ordinary airport with noise contours being established. Additionally, and as was pointed out by the Environment Court, the difficulty with using this approach is that it assumes the application of the airport noise management procedure in the standard, which identifies and designates noise contours, and they end up being carried over normally into the district plan maps, and there's none of that here. Well, it's a far mess trip. I've got a bit of a mess in 52. Can I just read that last sentence out? As things currently stand, cross out as, the maximum noise level from the aircraft, cross out the basis of, from the aircraft by reference to the noise assessment done by Dr. Trevathan. Sorry, this is a mess. The operation needs to be crossed out. Cannot presently comply with the requisite current noise standards, nor will they. Maybe I'll give you a new page. I saw that on the way down at the plane. I'll redo it and send you a replacement page.
Yeah, you can do that tomorrow, that'd be fine.
Okay, so last paragraph, and thank you for giving me your time. There is no evidence in support of the JRDM submission by the property owner or another party able to speak on its behalf to indicate that the use of the airstrip for aerial top dressing or by skydive would be discontinued if the submission was accepted and residential development as requested provided for. Neither the Jardine evidence nor the legal submissions for Jardine provide any information about the current lease obligation with skydive, but the council reports and evidence, I can't remember where I read it, indicate that the lease obligation with skydive extends to 2031, because he didn't reveal that in the Environment Court, nor did he give evidence. That is a further and important reason why making provision for land use activities which are incompatible with the continued operation of a farm airstrip and a commercial skydiving operation is inappropriate in this district plan review, and submission 715 ought to be rejected.
Do you have any questions?
No, I did want to say Mr. Geddes has a section 32 on page, section 7 of his evidence in chief does a section 32 in the start that he does them.
And I must say that if that's right and I missed it, the problem is he's made all sorts of alterations since then.
Honestly, I have the same struggle that you did.
Yeah.
No, Mr. Chair, I might just wait and hear them.
In your paragraph 9,
yes,
when you refer to the land west of State Highway 6 and north of the Note Factory and through the Kawara River, you almost need to.
Through to.
Yeah, you almost need to be with it. And we've looked at that land ourselves, and it's an obvious candidate, but I put it to you that it's pretty speculative at this stage and not, has even less of a process than JRD.
Well, I remember Marion Reed actually referring to that and how she considered that that land would, you know, the development of that land would follow. The two
the difficulty, of course, is it's owned by somebody who isn't likely to develop in the next century.
Well, with respect, I don't think that's the basis on which you do this sort of planning. There must be some reason why the urban growth boundary and the notified plan has been taken out to and includes Jack's Point. I mean, that's what's happened. And if you do that, then the next thing is that council commits to infrastructure provision as far as the southern end of that block. Those are two key building blocks of enabling urban development there. By contrast, the Jardine farm property on the far side of Jack's Point is neither within the urban growth boundary, nor has it got any infrastructure provision as the Hanley Downs land and the land. All I'm doing is conceding that if there's going to be some changes out our way, if I can put it that way, it would seem to me that that land that travels back towards Frankton has got the attributes that match the strategic direction objectives that this land doesn't have. That's all I'm saying. I'm not promoting this
development. We probably share your frustrations, but I'm not sure we can rely on it.
Well, I don't know, but I mean, you zone land and people don't have to take advantage of it. I just repeat my position, which is this is opportunistic sprawl, and it hasn't got reticulation, and it hasn't got proven infrastructure. I guess that's where I'm coming.
Thank you, Mr. President. I don't have any questions because I had the advantage of hearing you on spring night.
Yeah, thank you.
And Mr. Chair, the Twin Burn Area Resource Study has been referred to several times. Do we have it?
There's a revised and updated version that was done for Plan Change 44, and I'm sure that it was taken advantage of, if I can put it that way, during the Topic 9 hearing.
I can see it.
And I think the Henley Downs interest.
Ms. Banks, could we have the revised Twin Burn study provided to us, please? I think Ms. Jones will have it.
And Joe Tavener's evidence does reference it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She
gave a study. Was it just an extra paper?
Well, she referred to the study actually deals with this particular bit of land and identifies it as with a low absorption capacity. I mean, I've got a copy in my office, but I wasn't able to find it. And it's not my field of expertise, but my point is that it is the definitive work that was used to establish this, and it's been used since.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you very much.
I'm adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.